taking about 3 countries and measure the success that they have with small businesses and attracting investors, and how that has contributed in declining the economy. I mean, in reducing the unemployment rate. I must say to Sebastian, what is going to happen is that we'll find many businesses reluctant to come into South Africa. And if businesses are reluctant to come to South Africa, we'll be then working against the idea of the president during the State of the Nation address, where he says we should be doing everything possible to contribute in the job creation. Now, if we are in favor of what he said during the State of the Nation address, this is not going to assist. We should find a way. I mean, I seek guidance here from the officials. We are a committee, and our goal is to engage on this, and because we want to do some justice and obviously ensuring that South Africa becomes number one. Now, if you want to become number one, you start to do everything that's right and compare with others who are doing much better than you so that you can benchmark yourself properly. Now, what are we basing this on? Which country are we comparative to that applies these things in the manner in which we are doing it? And to what extent have they grown, have they reduced unemployment with a similar kind of legislation in dealing with businesses? So that is a very major area of concern, which if not dealt with, we might find ourselves shooting ourselves on the foot. So that is a very serious matter for us. As the year gets born, and never to be
Ngiyabonga again, Sonny Shola. You arrived late, like you have said, honorable member. We had apologized to the committee why the meeting was scheduled for 9 o'clock and stated our reason. So, sorry about that, but we did apologize to the committee. But I think we need to discuss this thing of permanent employment. Because we speak of employing and especially South Africans. But you know, I'm sorry, I'm from the trade union movement. Now, if we speak of permanent employment, is it the contract workers that you are comparing? I'm not sure. You'll come after that. But I'm worried because if we say just employ, maybe on contract, and in most cases, workers lose out, especially on benefits. They don't get the medical aid, they don't get the UIF, they don't get their pension because they are on contract. Maybe somebody will have to enlighten me, because if people speak of their contract workers, I'm told, because I've long left the trade union movement, I'm told that they don't have such benefits. Can somebody maybe enlighten me?
Yes,
you will. Mm-hmm. Over to you on the room.
Sebastian, fortunately, as we speak, I have a domestic helper at home who I have to register. And she is not working for me permanently, but she does work some days. That amounts to a number of hours, and the hours then amount to the benefit. So what matters is the hours that the person works for. But also the benefit will then be congruent to the benefit that the person who is employed permanently will get on the issue of the UIF. So the UIF, anyone can apply for it, and it's very clear within the Labor Relations Act. Now, the area of medical aid and other benefits, obviously, each company works differently from the other. But I may not really be qualified to speak on what companies do in terms of that. Because other people you find in South Africa, they are employed permanently, but they have never enjoyed the benefits of a medical aid. So I think what we need here in seeking to address this particular clause is that, yes, we need to emphasize on the decent working environment. There's no good, we don't have to compromise on that. We don't want people to be exploited or be put in a position where they have to accept anything because of the manner in which they are desperate. However, a situation of creating an environment for businesses to come and favor our own system is something that should be seen as very much a matter of importance, so that we don't create a situation where people say, yes, we hear the call, South Africa is keen to accept businesses, but the manner in which you are treated will not allow us to grow the business and sustain the kind of business that we're bringing to South Africa. Because when you bring a prescription that employs me permanently, you can even say, if this person is not performing, this person cannot. Because if a person is not performing, there should be a measure to deal with that person. So we should actually treat their environment, the working conditions should be equivalent to the working conditions of South African firms. Because we're not giving them instructions that employ people permanently. We are saying decent work or labor conditions is what we're calling for. And we're supporting that. Now, we're simply calling for a better way to craft this kind of a clause without compromising quality. So I'm sure with the legal group that is here, and obviously the immigration officials, we should be able to understand what it is that will work better without chasing these people and the investment away. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Lovemore. Yes, we want investors in our country, but we don't want our country to get it as well. Mm-hmm. I agree with Honorable Lovemore.
Okay, yes, absolutely, I agree with you too, and I think we can't but agree with you. Excuse me, but we do have labour legislation. And home affairs legislation should not be labour legislation. Excuse me, I just think of, for instance, now we've taken out the section that did not allow SMEs to establish. Basically, that was the section dealing with the waiver. So small businesses can establish in South Africa. Small business establishes within 1 year, they are required. 1 year is a very short time. They're required to employ a certain percentage or number of citizens or permanent residents. They might not be in a position to employ permanently, but maybe within 5 years they can employ double the number of prescribed. So simply removing that word permanently, remove the word permanently, all the labour legislation will be applicable that we have in South Africa, and that should be adequate protection for the employees. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Honourable Lovemore. Could we maybe ask for the state law advisor to come in and the parliamentary law advisor also to help us in this permanent employment and or other issues that you feel you want to come in? Over to you, then.
While members were asking their question, confer with the department and saying ask someone saying that one should be paid as employment according to the labor laws of the country. That would be good. And everything forward is someone saying that putting almost the word in that put employer according to the laws of the country. So we will find And the other issue that I would say, it's also what Mr. Gama said, that in terms of the regulations, the regulations are published in the Gazette. And then in terms of the interpretation, those regulations, all the regulations are published in terms of the certain period.
We will make the necessary changes, Chairperson, and I think do the insert in terms of in compliance with our labour laws or labour legislation and take out permanently as suggested. Chairperson, if I may just refer to some of the issues that was raised by Honourable Member Nkasela with regard to the confusion between visa and permit. Internationally now, this is what happens now, if I could just give as per example. Someone travels to South Africa, requires a visa to travel to South Africa, applies to our missions abroad and says, I want to visit South Africa as a tourist. They then give him a visa, a tourist visa or a visitor's visa for a period of 30 days, 90 days, whatever the case. And that allows the airline to board him and to move him to a South African port. When he arrives at the South African port and at immigration, when he presents his passport, he is then given a visitor's permit. And a visitor's permit is then put into his passport, stating the conditions on that permit. Now, which means it's two permits for the same purpose that is issued. It is a visa that allows him to travel, and then there's a permit which allows him to sojourn in the country for a particular period of time. Two permits that are issued. Similar with the other types of visas and permits. You would apply for a visa to travel to South Africa to work. When you get to the port of entry, you are now inserted in your passport is a work permit that allows you to work. So to obviate that and to make it simpler, we are saying we should be issuing work visas that allows you to sojourn to travel and sojourn in the country. One, you should have a visitor's a work visa that allows you to travel and to work in South Africa. And same with all our temporary, what we call now temporary residence permits. We believe it simplifies that and also brings down an administrative function of having to put in another permit into a document. Secondly, the interpretation of a visa is one of short stays, whereas the interpretation of a permit is always for longer stay. And we find that even our courts confuse that and say that no, this person has a permit to be in South Africa and should be allowed in South Africa to stay. And we are also trying to obviate that interpretation, where we are that saying that if you talk about a visa, it's always interpreted as a short stay, whereas a permit denotes a much longer stay in a particular, in a country. Thank you, Chairperson. And then with regard to the issue of the interviews at borders, I think that it still remains, it will be in the regulations as we have stated. Of course, we will make sure, as we said, that it is within our laws and our constitution and our human rights charter. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Lasma. Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to clarify this issue of regulations. And, Chair, I'm not sitting here trying to, in any way, I mean, it's not my aim to cast aspersions on the department. There are certain realities, however. The department faces litigation regularly, as a result of human rights infringements. Lawyers for Human Rights is constantly busy with cases that are based on human rights infringements. There is a very bad record in this department. So I hear what Mr. McKay says, that we are not likely to put forward anything that infringes human rights. I have my doubts, quite frankly, based on past experience. I also hear what Advocate Gaum says, that the courts can test. Well, somebody has to be traumatized. Somebody has to know the right process to follow so that they can actually take the case to court. Otherwise, it doesn't get to court to be tested. The fact is, and it costs money, it costs time, it costs expertise, etc. The fact is that we are elected public representatives and we can do the testing. Now, our state law advisor has said that that regulations come to Parliament. I have never seen regulations. They might go to somebody's office, but they certainly don't come to our committee. They certainly don't come to our committee for discussion. When they are gazetted, they are not gazetted for public comment before they are finally promulgated. So there is no mechanism for participation at all. As I say, somebody will have to be traumatized, and in most cases it's many people who will be traumatized before cases get to court. Why not simply look at those issues about which the committee is most concerned and say, we want to see those regulations, we want to test them. But I would like clarity, and we can take that forward, but I would like clarity, if possible, from the state law advisor on when he says they come to Parliament, where do they go, who looks at them, etc. Also, Chair, I just want to point out that I fully understand that the department is saying that they don't agree with this. The fact is that this legislation doesn't belong to the department at the moment. It belongs to Parliament. It is our legislation. It is for us to discuss and for us to decide upon, and not in fact, the department. Thank you, Chair. State Law Advisor.
Thank you, ma'am. Chair, what I'm saying is this. The regulations, whichever regulations, the proclamation that the minister makes, any minister that makes, there's a certain period that those regulations, as the minister is required to submit them to Parliament. They come to Parliament, actually maybe the thing that I didn't qualify is that they come to Parliament for information purposes. You know, they are published in the ATC for information purposes, because it is required in the interpretation. As I said, it's either Section 15 or Section 17, I'm not quite sure, but the minister is required each and every delegated legislation that the minister makes, either it's a proclamation or it's regulation, they are submitted to Parliament in terms of the Interpretation Act. At the moment, there is no legislation, for instance, the Constitution in Section 101, it says, for instance, national legislation is specified the manner in which, for instance, an extent to which instruments mentioned in subsection 3, that is wrong with the regulation, the proclamation, and other instruments may be tabled in Parliament and must be approved by Parliament. At this moment, there is no such legislation, general legislation, that requires that the legislation must be approved by Parliament. As I've said in the last meeting, as you have said, for instance, in terms of the corrections, it differs at the moment. There is no, let's say, standard way of regulation getting approved by Parliament. It differs from legislation to legislation. But I just wanted to identify the way that there is no regulation that the minister makes that it does not come to Parliament anyway. All the regulation that the minister makes, the Interpretation Act requires that they must be submitted to Parliament for information purposes. Yes.
In the absence of anyone on the city, may I thank you, Chairperson? Yeah, I was busy looking at my small book here, yeah. Very thick and good thinking book, and I found that yes, you are correct. Section 101.3, but it simply talks to accessibility and availability of the information to public. The point that we are making, which we've been making from the very outset, that we should try and ensure that we create a spirit of trust, one, and the spirit of good cooperation between the department and us as the committee. Hence, some of the suggestions which were made were easily comfortable with the fact that, oh yes, it will be in the regulation. And from the very outset, it was made clear that yes, we'll have an opportunity to sit down and look at the regulations before the minister finalizes them. Just to ensure that we are comfortable with the with some of the areas of concern which the department suggested that it would be easier to accommodate them in the regulation. For instance, the issue that I've just raised now, Chairperson, through you to Mr. McKay, is that the interviews at the border post and the manner in which some of these interviews will be carried out will somehow create a situation where some people may become victims somehow, and not because the department aims to achieve such, but because of the officials who may have lack of experience and the wherewithal to understand what it is that they have to do in terms of the law. And I've mentioned the area of the RSTOs, and I've lifted the issue of a Ugandan national who is now facing prosecution in his country because of the lack of experience with the RSTOs, because that is the background. If you go and investigate that matter, you will find that this gentleman was simply a victim of a situation, of a process which was meant to protect him. Now, the point here, honorable members, I'm trying to canvass your views and understanding and support that we get the regulations presented to us, because it will serve us all good. Then we can sit down. I know it's a very anomaly. It's an anomaly that the regulations come and we debate them. But simply because of the nature of this, and we're making that request so that we are able to sit down and say, trying to piggyback on some of these areas that are of great concern to us, so that we don't legislate via the regulation but we legislate in the manner in which we should, which is in the Act, but we have allowed a situation where some of the serious areas that we should be legislating, we would defer them to the regulation. So based on that trust which we gave to the department, again, that is our kita. We are upetting gomozako, yonki indi ngobos, namakuko, unenze ngozobuza obu yonki. Now the white department and now was looking at back. Next time, we say, now, all we are saying, the hand washes the other. And if we don't allow that to occur, then there will be no more relations. You'll find that every time the department comes here, members are simply hungry to attack because they see that the department is not trustworthy. But the department might somehow feel that the committee is not treating them well and not, you know, have enjoying the kind of relationship and cooperation and trust that we want to both enjoy. So that is my appeal. It might be an anomaly, but in a very abnormal situation like we find ourselves in, we have to accept that some of these are going to be abnormal. My plea, sir, and I'm hoping that I've made my point clear. Thank you very much.
I want to suggest, you know, that we've really exhausted this particular topic, and you know, the other matters that the department has canvassed with us today. Now, there are clearly two views. The one view is that the regulation should be approved by this committee, and the other view is that you know, the regulations need not to be approved. So obviously parties can vote according to whatever view they hold next time, but as these are the formal deliberations on the poll, I would suggest that you allow comments now and deliberation on, you know, the rest of the bill as a whole. Not necessarily, we don't have to do it clause by clause at this stage because we're not voting, but if there are any comments, maybe, you know, on other aspects of the bill, that parties would now mention those. That's just a suggestion.
Another one, love more. Chair, I don't fully agree that we've exhausted it. Well, I'll accept that we'll stop now because I don't think we're going to get any further on the regulations today. We'll continue the fight. May I ask additional questions? Chairperson, item one of the proposed amendments refers to the revised proposed amendments which have been presented to us today, refers to the change of status and conditions in the country. Now, 6B refers to visitors' visas. Is that meant to refer only to the 90-day visitors' permits or visas? The current wording includes extended visitors' permits, for example, to accompany a family member on a work permit or to conduct research or voluntary work, etc. So those persons, perhaps after having spent 3 years in the country, will then have to leave South Africa to change their status or conditions. Children accompanying their parents and then wishing to start school will have to leave South Africa. That, I'm sure, cannot be your intention. So the question is, does it only refer to 90-day visitors' permits or visas? And if so, can that be made clearer? Chair, there still are no transitional provisions, and this is a problem. Sorry, I just want to make sure that the DDG is hearing me. Okay, there still are no transitional provisions. It is a problem. There are businesses operating in South Africa today that might find themselves on that list of undesirables. What happens? There are no transitional provisions. So that has to be addressed. A very minor matter, but certainly something that has a major impact, is the definition of conveyances. As it stands at the moment, every minibus, taxi, everybody would have to provide lists of their passengers to the department, which I'm sure is not the intention. A major matter, Chair, is Section 46, the repeal of Section 46, which deals with the repeal, deals with the department not regulating any longer, not keeping a list any longer of immigration practitioners. When this was presented to us last year, what we were told was that the department wouldn't keep the list, the department wouldn't regulate. That was the first thing that was told to us this year in our first deliberations. This has substantially changed, Chair. Not in the bill itself. The bill remains the same, but certainly in the interpretation. The business day, and I don't like to use the newspaper as a source, a primary source, but nevertheless, the business day is certainly a credible newspaper. Mr. McKay is quoted here. He says, the unintended consequence of accepting applications from immigration specialists is the perpetuation and proliferation of corrupt practices within the department, Jackson McKay, Deputy Director General for Immigration, says. These practices have compromised the application process for permits to such an extent that some Home Affairs officials were on the payroll of some immigration agencies to perform favors. And he talks also about home officials who have the authority to process work permit applications deliberately doing this slowly when they haven't come through immigration officials, or immigration practitioners, rather. And it says here, this bill will empower the Department for Home Affairs to reject any permit applications lodged by immigration practitioners on behalf of foreign nationals. This bill does not empower that. All this bill does is make anybody entitled to be an immigration practitioner. This bill doesn't say the Department of Home Affairs, which I know that policy is already being implemented, and I've personally been at the receiving end of it as a public representative, being told that I cannot lodge queries on behalf of clients. This bill does not say this. What the department is doing is laying the blame for slow working officials with which it must deal, for corrupt immigration practitioners, and I know there are some. I'm dealing with queries where people have paid thousands and got absolutely nowhere, for corrupt immigration official practitioners at the door of those who provide a legitimate business. If the department is not capable of regulating, allow, as was suggested in the beginning, a time period for this sector of our economy to become self-regulating. If we, as we do in South Africa, have a free market economy, we would not have a sector of that economy existing if there wasn't a need for it. There is a need for a chair. There is a need for it. There is nothing in this bill that precludes the Department of Home Affairs dealing with immigration practitioners. What they are doing in practice, however, and what appears to be the policy, is to kill off immigration practitioners. It certainly came through very strongly when the minister addressed us, and in her subsequent media statements, if you read them. And this is the kind of thing, Chair, that I'm very, very anxious about, will be in the regulations. It will be. And we won't be able to do a thing about it. We won't be able to do a thing about it. But I'd like very much Mr. McKay's comment on the latest thinking about immigration practitioners, because what is reported is very, very different from what actually is in the bill and what was presented to us by Mr. Apleni in November last year. Then lastly, Chair, you might well have seen the latest CDE report entitled South Africa's Migration Policies, a Regional Perspective. This summarizes a roundtable discussion held in November last year. It was published this month. There was a presentation made by Dr. John Carnison, and it would be very nice to have him presenting to our committee. He is the Chief Director of Policy and Strategic Management at the Department of Home Affairs. His paper was entitled South Africa's Changing Migration Policies. Now, Chair, he says, inter alia, we must actively seek talent. Until now, South Africa has been too passive in the global contest for talent, and he talks about what we have to do there. And then he says, we are undertaking a comprehensive review of the legislative framework governing migration. But he also says that we believe that the urgency of some of the issues warrants legal amendments. These will soon be in the public domain, and these are indeed the ones that are before us now. So what Dr. Carnison, is a doctor? Yes, Dr. John Carnison was referring to was those urgent issues that need to be addressed immediately, not the entire migration regime. That is something that is still coming. And I would appreciate a comment on that, but particularly the visas, the transitional provisions, and the immigration practitioners. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Lovemore. If I remember, I think the Minister did address the advanced passenger processing in the last meeting. She was. She did, and...
Just the definition of conveyances at the moment includes in-car, in-taxi, etc. So that must be changed.
What should be changed, Honourable Lovemore?
The definition.
I'm not sure if that is possible, but to hear the department. Mr. McKay?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, to start with the conveyances, it is every conveyance, it doesn't matter who you are, what car, bicycle, you need to declare to an immigration officer who's on your bicycle, who's in your car, and who's in your boot. No, ma'am. We are talking about coming into the country. And I thought we had dealt, sorry, Chairperson, through you, I thought we had dealt with this issue before on the domestic travel in the previous, when we were here previously. Mm-hmm. Chairperson, could I just correct some issues?
Mr. McKay, yeah. I'm sorry, let me just come in there. If I remember what the minister said was that the people come into the country illegally and are not known. We don't have documentation, we don't have any knowledge of them. And at times you find that these are people who are prohibited or fugitives from other countries. That is why there was that's why there's this conveyance or whatever, even in the country. You can proceed, Mr. McKay.
So, can you
just
clarify,
even the domestic, if I'm correct, even the domestic, the requirements for domestic conveyance lists, you know, like every aeroplane that departs in from Bloemfontein to Joburg, that list of passengers is required to be submitted to the Department of Home Affairs. It uses the word conveyance. So that will have to be, it does, it uses the word conveyance. So that will have to be looked at. For domestic, we don't want to know about every, I mean, surely, don't want to know about every minibus, taxi, etc.
Mr. McKay, or CSC?
Thank you, Chair. Just to give clarity, on page 10 of the bill, at clause 21, that's where we talk about duties with regard to conveyances, especially if you go to 2. It says the owner or person in charge of a prescribed conveyance entering into, and that's where we are going to indicate which types of conveyances will be required to comply with the duties that we are coming up with. And necessarily the issue about APP is going to be phased in gradually. For example, currently we are dealing with flights or airlines. We do not have the system currently for your vehicles or minibuses, so it will be a phased-in approach. And the other example that one could perhaps give is, if we are going to specifically exclude, for example, minibuses that might be transporting people within the country, and you happen to, with the examples that we, I'll give maybe through Bedbridge, you happen to get people who come in illegally, not through the port of entry, then get into a minibus, and you come across such people in that minibus, and you exclude them specifically from the duties that are with regard to owners or persons in charge of conveyance, we might have a problem in dealing with those particular persons. And generally, the law says we give you duties that you need to comply with. For example, if you transport any person into the Republic, make sure that that person has got the necessary documents to enter the Republic. But if we allow a situation where we particularly exclude certain categories, we are going to enter into an area that I think might not be the intention to sort of classify them as not having to comply with particular duties. And as I indicated, we are going to, the intention is to gradually move into, and I think last it was indicated in the responses that we are currently with the airlines, we want to move to the marine or shipping type of conveyances and the like. Thank you.
Chairperson, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, if I could maybe just set try to set the record straight on some issue that was discussed or that was mentioned by Honourable Lovemore earlier. Indeed, and I don't want to open up the debate, Chairperson, but I thought it is necessary to make the point. Indeed, the department is challenged on issues in court, like I said, sometimes daily there are issues. But it is never, Chairperson, on, or most of the time, it is on practice or behavioral issues, as I think Honourable Ngasela mentioned earlier, in terms of how interpretation by our officers, and also the training that they have received, or the lack of training that they have received, that is challenged in court. It is never about the law or our regulations that has been ruled as being ultra vires, or has been ruled as a contra to our constitution or our Bill of Rights. I thought I would just make that statement, Chairperson. On the issue of the immigration practitioners, I think when our Director General made the presentation initially to the Portfolio Committee, he mentioned that we intend to repeal Section 46, and because it is based on the need for us as a department to be able to interact directly with clients, and also with regard to our risk methodology that we are going to implement in terms of monitoring who is issued a document by the Department of Home Affairs, and also the fact that South Africans are required to go to the Department of Home Affairs when they need documentation, and we expect foreigners to be able to present themselves to the department as well when they require documents from the department. Chairperson, on the issue of the newspaper article, I can't really comment on that. I think all of us in this house sometimes make interviews or are interviewed by newspapers, and what comes out the next day in that newspaper is not what was discussed in that particular interview. For instance, I spent 2 hours with that interview from the Daily, from the Business Day. 2 full hours I spent with him. And what he then wrote was that article over there with a piece of it in, totally out of context, totally out of in terms of the discussions that we had. So I can't answer for him. I don't know why he put it in the newspaper, and why I have been quoted in that particular way. And I don't think I am. I am yet to answer what I said for those 2 hours, but really in those 2 hours we spoke about a range of issues and reasons why we said we need to relook we needed to have these amendments done, and I gave reasons, and it was in response, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members, it was in response to a first article that was written in the Business Day in an editorial that also misquoted and gave a totally wrong picture of why we are trying to do the to change or amend the Act. And the reason why we had that interview was to try and set the record straight in terms of the department's view of why the amendments. So, Chairperson, really, I can't answer for that.
I'm very sorry to interject. I really would, and I hate to have to be forced into being confrontational, but if this committee is going to exercise, and it is its job, to exercise oversight over the department, and secondly, to adequately legislate, we actually have to understand the reasons why there are being changes made to legislation. So Mr. McCaig cannot say to us that he doesn't see that he has to explain to us his thinking. I mean, I don't expect a verbatim report of the 2 hours of Business Day, but surely we must understand exactly where the department sits with respect to the repeal of Section 46. We're going to have to discuss it.
Lovemore, let us not go backward, because we have discussed that extensively. Section 46 was discussed. The minister has put the position with regard to Section 46, and I actually don't understand why we are bringing it up again. I seriously don't understand why we are bringing it up again. But Mr. McKay will respond to what he's going to respond, whatever he wants to respond to, Mr. Honorable Lovemore. I don't think we should press him to bring the two-hour interview here. I don't think it's fair. No, I don't think it's fair, Honorable Lovemore. Mr. McKay, over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the issue of practitioners, I think, was covered adequately by my minister when she was here, and I'm not going to cover that ground again unless the chair says that I need to. But Chairperson, the Dr. Carnison's article that was referred to by the member, by the honourable member, and I hope I'm not being seen as being rude here again, because I'm answering the questions or responding to the questions in terms of the question asked. I was told to explain the interview, not to state why the reasons why our thinking is around immigration practitioners. With regard to Dr. Carnison's article, Dr. Carnison there makes the point that the department is looking at our immigration policy or regime as a whole, as a long-term issue, that we are looking at we have seen a few gaps, policy gaps, and we need to see how we deal with it. One of those policy gaps, for instance, is the issue of economic migrants from our neighboring states. How do we deal with them adequately? And our current immigration regime does not assist us really to adequately deal with them, because there's a lot of immigrants coming from our neighboring countries that come here to South Africa to work, but they do not qualify as per the Immigration Act as it is now, the requirements of the Act, which then forces them to use the asylum seeker process to legitimize the stay whilst they are in South Africa. So what we would need to look at as a policy thing, and we are working on it now as a medium to long term, is to have a look at how can we change our policy to accommodate such migrants from the region. And also we are of the opinion that our current policy is a bit outdated and does not take into consideration the migration patterns and realities that we see now within the SADC region, and we need to align that with that. Also, I think it deals with he then alludes to it that what we are trying to do in this act over here, or these amendments over here, is really to look at urgent issues which we think that bedevils the immigration issues now and causes and what we are trying to do with this amendment is to fix some short-term issues that would assist us to better manage migration within this particular period of time. And he is correct, because we've identified those when we came to the portfolio committee to make the presentation, which our DG did. It was clear why we needed to have these amendments that's before the House now, and why we view them as critical for us to be able to manage migration effectively whilst we are still looking at the broader policy issues that we need to look at, the policy gaps that we need to address. And I think that is all that Dr. Carnison is saying in that excerpt that is in that document. I don't know if there's anything. I hope I have answered it adequately, but I think that is what he was trying to put across in that document. The chairperson, on the issue of transitional arrangements or provisions, I think this as well was discussed, and it was clear that this act is not retrospective, and that an advice from the state law advisors and discussion of on the issue, they were clear that there's no need for transitional arrangements or transitional provisions in the act, because it is not going to be applied retrospectively. Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Silibimich, advocate.
Thank you. I'll have to amend my surname. There is one question that is not answered relating to the change of status. An example that could be given under Section 11, where an adult person is having dependents who, for example, might be on academic sabbatical or voluntary charitable case, which might be, for example, for a period not exceeding 3 years. If we take an example of 3 years maximum, what will happen to the children if they are not school going and they need to be to attend school? Also, I think there will have to be a necessary change in terms of their status or condition, because you will not be able to issue a permit for a child, for example, who's not school going, to say he should go to school, whereas he's not. So you need to apply some measures. So you just a minor issue that needs to be attended to procedurally, in terms of so that you comply and you get the necessary permit. It's not going to complicate any issues, for as long as the parent, or if I can use the example of a parent, is still within the validity period of his or her permit. Thank you.
I think we have come to the end of the discussion with regard to issues that were outstanding, and also some of the issues that were raised by honorable members. We are not going to vote on the bill today. Honorable Lovemore actually written a letter to request that we delay that until we have thoroughly went through. I think today we have done that. And we will be voting on the bill in our next meeting, which will be next week. And we would like all parties to consult with their caucuses so that next week when we vote from party mandates. We don't have a problem that day. We still need to go and consult. I would like to thank you, honorable members, on that note. The next item is SONA by Mr. Salmon.
Good morning, honorable members. I've just given you an updated version of the document I distributed last week. It provides a little bit more detail than the document last week, including the program of how the state of the nation falls in line with the government's program of action. In addition, the last section of the document deals with what progress was made by the department in terms of the state of the last year's state of the nation address. This is for progress. Just in terms of what progress has been made. Not entirely sure if we necessarily need to go through the entire document now. It's more like a reference document for the members to be able to engage whenever we have the department here, so that they have some kind of frame of reference and they make sure that their interrogation falls within the bigger picture set by the government. So I can go through it piece by piece, but it's basically just a reference. It's a reference document, I think. Okay. So I already went through the sections last week, but it just basically gives some additional details. So if you look at the first section on job creation through meaningful transformation and inclusive growth, I included some of the performance statistics of the department in terms of how they procure skills, again relating to today's business, the dire need for importing skills such as teachers. That goes in the third paragraph on the second page, and there's a specific detail about that. There's also on the last paragraph of that page a reference to the program of action, which was done over for a 2-year period last year, and there's still outstanding commitments that the department needs to follow in terms of government's program of action. Which also the 12-step program outcomes, 12 outcomes, strategic outcomes in the program of action, and these relate to the business in the following in outcome 5, which relates to skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path, and particularly the Home Affairs needs to develop the framework for information on skills usage, inflow and outflow of skills in the country. So they've had a number of meetings about this, but they still need to establish the list of exactly shortages, and I mean, this is something that they're required to do as a result of the changes to this act. So they'll need to be done by the end of this year, so it's an ongoing concern throughout the year that they keep on track with that. Consulting with the relevant partners on the framework until consensus is reached. Basically, this is just saying that the department needs to speak to other role players such as labour and education and economic development, as was also stated during the course of today's meeting. And then also making sure that those are done according to national and international standards. So I've just extracted the aspects of the program of action where they're relevant. Public service performance and monitoring. The section is largely the same as the last document that I've specifically mentioned again, the program of action requirements, which is outcome 12 of the program of action, which is includes things like service user satisfaction and access to government services, which basically requires the department to cooperate with DPSA in terms of doing a client survey, a satisfaction survey by the end of this year to see whether they're actually performing in the areas that they've indicated are their service delivery targets. There's also specific targets, and these are also requirements that are specifically mentioned in the performance agreement of the minister. So in our interactions with the ministry, specifically with the department, those particular criteria are set out in her performance agreement. Then, again, the continued fight against corruption. I give the aspects from the government plan of action. And there's two things that the department specifically needs here, in addition to what was said last week, is that they need training programs for anti-corruption practitioners. I've seen no indication of this And so perhaps the department could brief us on how they're training people and who's doing what in terms of anti-corruption. And then there's also a public sector integrity management framework, which started being rolled out last year and which needs implementation this year. So Home Affairs, it would be interesting to see what Home Affairs' role in contributing to that is going to be and how they're going to implement it. The local elections, there were no real additional changes to that section. And I think basically also just, as is going to happen today with the engagement with the EU, there needs to be more engagement with this committee with these international fora, such that we make sure that the migration remains on the agenda and that we're not operating in discordance with the international events. Even if we don't necessarily attending all these international fora, it's also partially my responsibility to make sure that the members are aware of when these fora are happening, so that when there are immigration and migration related issues, that we keep informed about them and also inform those processes. I've been involved throughout the last year, or all of my years here, that I always do papers for these international fora. So I'll make sure that these are available, for instance, to the committee prior, so that they can also know when they're happening and what's being discussed. So that we have a more regional and international focus kind of context when the committee is doing its work. The SALIC protocol is also keeps on being kind of sidelined every year, so this is kind of re-emphasized every year. Even though the department's not emphasizing it anymore, it's still not being implemented. But everybody's signed, everybody's on board, they just haven't actually implemented it yet, so that's still outstanding and needs to be kind of pushed. Then the other part of the document is just showing where the department is performing or underperforming compared to its imperative, or its last focus on the State of the Nation last year. The first being with IDs. There's a little table there showing what their targets were and what they actually achieved. So they were a little behind their expected targets in terms of delivery time of IDs, and also on the number of IDs. So the time is something they can be required to explain, but the number is a variation. It depends on how many people demand, or that's not necessarily an indication of performance. It's just there for reference purposes. There was a decline in service delivery in terms of these times last year, and then slightly in 2009. In 2010, it improved again. And we need to make sure that they don't decline again, because there's going to be additional demand because of the extension of child support grants from 16 to 18. There'll be additional IDs, and there'll also be additional requirements for IDs for the elections. So there'll be additional demand to make sure that they don't fall into a backlog again, and how they're planning to deal with that backlog. Are they going to have additional capacity, or what are they going to do? The efforts against identity theft. There were a lot of things that were done, but again, the two major projects that fell out of line because of procurement and other issues were the Smart ID Card and the Who Am I Online project, both of which are kind of in an undefined status. The Smart ID Card communications from the department it seems to be stalled at this stage. They haven't finalized that. And the Who Am I Online project is still sub judice. It seems as if the department is coming to some kind of out-of-court settlement, and they're unwilling to disclose what's happening there until that's finalized. But it still needs to be monitored in terms of maintaining, making identity theft more secure. Public service monitoring. Again, this is relating to much of the same issues as I have mentioned for the current State of the Nation address, just indicating what was done last year. No real issues there, other than, basically making sure that I'm not sure if we're still going to address the strategic plan of the committee next week, are we going to do the bull and the strategic plan together, or are we going to have to change that? Okay, but well, whatever the case may be, making sure that the plan of action and the strategic plan are in concordance. They've improved in that, but there's always, sometimes there's a possibility of a discrepancy, just to make sure that they fall in line with the bigger picture. And the program of action is a lot more user-friendly this year. There's a program of action website, and so you can kind of check how each individual department, each particular minister is falling in line with the bigger picture, whether they're keeping up with it and keeping things on track. So it's an easier task to do this year, and I'll make sure that I include it in my briefings. Continued efforts against corruption. The late registration of births, that's one thing that's going to come up that's still due this year. It's supposed to be phased out by the end of 2012, so there's going to be processes throughout the year that will need to be monitored. And the counter-corruption, we mentioned this before in terms of the ID fraud, but the counter-corruption unit hasn't really been reported on extensively in the annual reports or the medium-term budget statement of the department. So that still needs to be reported on. We need more clarity on that, because that's quite a pivotal thing. That's a continuing concern for the department. The logistics around the FIFA World Cup, that was obviously last year. There they did really relatively well. The only real concern was around human trafficking, and that didn't seem to be a huge problem. There were a few isolated reports, but nothing over and above what usually happens. Then the last is the regional integration. The one thing that's outstanding there is that by the end of this year, the department needs to have a uni visa or visa exemption agreement for the SADC region, which also kind of ties into the SADC protocol. So both of those things need to happen, and it appears as if, from what the Director General is saying, that they are looking at the long-term regional approach to migration, but specific deadlines need to be fulfilled in terms of the uni visa and visa exemption agreements, and also then the facilitation agreements of persons, the static protocol. So that just gives a slightly broader perspective. This is a comparative thing. I'm also willing to obviously give any additional information that's required. And there's a list of references in more detail that's required.
Thank you, Adam. Maybe questions for clarity time is against us. Is there any questions? Honorable Masena?
Thank you, Sebastian. I know the President, in dealing with the question of being prone in giving the detail, he made it a clear point that he intends to give that to ministers. But one would have hoped that there should be clarity now on the movement or on the transition of moving away from the current ID document into a smart ID card. Because it's something that has got to come from top, from the very helm of the organization, of government, to say when and how fast are we going to move towards the smart ID card. And you remember when we engaged last year, and obviously the year before last, there has been a uniformity from the side of the minister that every year when the minister addressed the committee, she has always been saying, we want to start this soon, and want to start this soon. But when, how soon? So it's something that we have to carry on raising. I understand that there was a problem with the tender document, and then the tender was then withdrawn, and the money had now to be transferred and be used elsewhere. And there was an embargo at some stage that it cannot be used for that and that because of the questions around it. But I think we've got to find a way, especially going to the budget debate, the budget vote debate that we're going to have. I would hope that the department will be able to, when the minister speaks to us, identify that this is urgent. People lose their IT books all the time. It's not user-friendly. And it's easy to find a person who's not from South Africa having an identity book of South Africa. You've seen if those, if some have watched the Cutting Edge in the last week. I've seen people from Lesotho get IDs from the chiefs who facilitate that through the bribery system. Now, these, even though we're trying to secure them, but our identity and the National Population Register is not safe. So we just need to ensure that the emphasis is there. I mean, the other one is the UMI Online project, which there is very little, and I know there is case pending and trying to settle out of court, but we just need some detail. We've been promised information, and many requests have been made, but nothing has been forthcoming on those. I think, generally, the issues around facilitation of movement and the uni visa will do much to contribute to the economic growth of the region. So I think that it's something that one is patiently waiting to see. But if you have South Africa only, that is growing and having good controls internally, and the rest of the other countries around South Africa simply become the consumers of what we have, then we'll have a porous borders, and we'll have a situation where South Africa simply, you know, feeds the rest of the SADC, and nothing that South Africa benefits directly. So we've got to see how best we manage that. Even bringing back Chairperson the agreement that we had to deal with in Lesotho, so that we see how best to address that area. I think besides that, I'm sure this will assist us in going forward as the document presented to us. Thank you.
Yeah, supporting your view, I think it's true that we do need to maybe get a report from the minister, maybe after she presents her budget speech, just to invite her to come and brief us, especially on this project of UMI Online, because you're right that I also heard that the department and the Gijima are settling out of court. Maybe get the information, let her brief us, and also tell us what the way forward is with regard to that project. Okay. Honorable members, I want to thank you. We will be meeting next week on the bill. And we have the summit, local government summit for next week. I urge all members to maybe contact Eddie with their names, those who would like to attend the summit, to contact Eddie. Honorable Makuba, you may leave mine because you did indicate that you are attending the social services meeting. You are allowed to leave. Honorable Lovemore.
Chair, thank you. Yes, I think we, from the DA, both submitted our 3rd of March, the IEC summit to Eddie. I just wanted to clarify, Chair, we received an invitation as a committee to a tourism summit on the 28th of March and the 1st of March, taking place in Old Assembly Chamber, and I just wanted to clarify what our position is on that one.
Yeah, also on that one, I think we need to maybe discuss as to would we want to attend, because wherever we do oversight, remember last time we were with tourism doing oversight work. So I think it will be proper that we attend there. Is it the summit also? Yeah, I think we can attend if maybe it's not within our program of our meeting. We will discuss that with Eddie and see where it falls. Okay, thank you. Thank you, honorable members. The meeting is adjourned.
Good evening.